is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, July 26, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. On April 17, 2024, a pro-Palestine protest encampment was built at Columbia University, where students called on their school to disclose and divest their investments in companies linked to Israel and its war on Gaza. This inspired a movement in universities across North America and the globe for students to create their own on-campus encampments. And after months of peaceful protest, the encampments at U of T, McGill, and U Ottawa have now been dismantled, but the pressure for divestment continues. Today on Rabble Radio, freelance reporter Stephen Wenzel sits down with journalist and activist Desmond Cole to outline the misconceptions some had about the student encampments and what responsible reporting for Palestine looks like. Here is that conversation. Take a listen.
So Desmond, to get started, we're going to talk a bit about Occupy U of T. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your coverage that you did throughout that time.
Oh, well, I probably went to the camp at U of T at least a dozen times during the course of it being there. And, you know, my coverage was mainly just focused on, you know, updates from the students at the camp who were running things. They would hold press conferences pretty regularly to give updates about everything from logistical issues of the camp, threats that they were facing from people outside who didn't like the fact that the camp was set up. I know they wanted to be talking a lot more than they were about their negotiations with the U of T administration and their demands to disclose investments and divest from any investments that were related to, you know, weaponry, that were related to support for the state of Israel, partnerships with academic institutions in Israel, particularly on occupied Palestinian territory. They didn't get to talk about that last piece as much, which was, of course, the reason for the demonstration, because a lot of what the school administration wanted to deal with was administrative. We need to get bathrooms in there or it'll be unsanitary. We need to figure out what's happening with the fence. I think it's worth noting actually for your listeners that one very misunderstood reality of the U of T camp is that it was enabled by a fence that was put up by the university. So a few days before the students actually went in May, there was a kind of news report that I saw where U of T kind of announced that it was watching what was happening in other places. It was watching what was happening, particularly in the United States of America with student protests on campus. And it didn't want them coming to U of T. And so it had put up a fence in order to try and stop demonstrators from coming out. And of course, the great irony is that without that fence, I don't think there would have been a 9-week occupation of, you know, King's College Circle, which was renamed the People's Circle for Palestine, simply because there were so many forces that didn't want these students there. And the fence kind of kept them safe in some way. It allowed them to have a perimeter and to keep people who were, in often cases, even being quite violent and aggressive towards them. And that fence allowed them to keep people out. So they spent a lot of time negotiating around the physical space itself and not as much time negotiating on the divest and disclose demands, ultimately, which were not met before an injunction forced the camp to end.
Can you talk about some of the misconceptions that were in the public about the demonstrations and how your coverage was able to kind of push back on some of that?
Well, you know, I think the students really spoke for themselves, and they said that the characterizations of this being a very violent or somehow aggressive and intimidating sort of space, really didn't stand up to any scrutiny. I mean, I was there regularly, and I can tell you what I saw was I would regularly see agitators coming to the front gate of where the students would let people in and out of the camp. There was only one entrance and exit, and that became a space of contention for people who wanted to go there and disrupt. So sometimes people would come and maybe they would just have some choice words, or they would swear at people in the inside or yell at people at the standing and guarding at the gates, and they would leave. Other times there were larger groups of people. Some nights, couple nights or a couple days, there were larger gathering of dozens, or even I think in one case more than 100 people, including people from the Jewish Defense League, which is a quite radical right extremist group, who brought Israeli flags and who chanted quite disgusting and racist slogans at the people inside. All of this was flipped in a lot of the media coverage. So the media would actually suggest that the violence and the threats and the intimidation were coming from people inside the camp. That's never what I observed, actually. And, with the exception of a couple of scuffles that I saw breaking out with people getting into it at the fence, I can't really think of anything that I witnessed that even involved the people who were camping in the space. Like, certainly I didn't see anything instigated by them. I saw things like, I saw a CP24 news report at some point during the camp, where students were interviewed and the students were saying, "We're being blocked from going to class." And this was an extraordinary claim because the camp wasn't near any classrooms. It wasn't near any buildings that were holding class. And I couldn't find any credible reports of any students from the camp moving to places where people were studying and blocking those spaces. And in fact, when CP24 allowed students to say this on camera, it didn't provide any evidence. The students didn't provide any. So there was this kind of always climate of a role reversal where, even though most of the threats and aggressive behavior was coming directed at people at the camp, it was flipped as a kind of, "You're making our school unsafe. You're making this campus unsafe," but never any evidence. And it was very interesting when a judge, in granting the injunction to U of T to allow it to clear the students, went into great detail about how, in the judge's view, he couldn't find any examples of students inside the camp saying anything that was hateful, saying anything that was violent. The judge even went into really large detail about, like, slogans that were being used, "From the river to the sea" or "Intifada," and broke them down one by one, talking about how these are contentious phrases in some cases, and they might make people feel bad, but that there was nothing in them that he saw that was violent. I certainly don't think we need a judge to make a final determination about things like that, but surely with having access to all that evidence, if there was something really glaring that the students had been doing wrong, I think the judge would have pointed it out, and he didn't. But those narratives persisted, unfortunately, in the mainstream.
Yeah, when we're thinking about right now, I'm in New York, and so we saw at Columbia, at the City University of New York, we saw the similar kinds of demonstrations that led to what picked up at Occupy U of T. And really, the only claims of violence that have any footing were caused by police, whether it be campus police, the NYPD, police in Ontario. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to the police violence that the demonstrators suffered during this time.
So there were some incidents of police and campus security forces using violence and using force against student demonstrators. One that sticks out for me was that very close to the end of the camp, there was a governing council meeting happening just outside of the circle in a building where the U of T's governing council meets. And I think it was their last meeting before their summer break. And so, they had a meeting there, and the students went right outside the building and held a demonstration there. And, I don't remember there being actual Toronto police officers there. There may have been one or two, but it was mainly U of T campus security who grabbed people and manhandled them and pushed them away from, the doors of that building right adjacent to the circle. Those kind of incidents were actually quite rare. As far as I'm aware, there weren't a lot of reports that I know of from students of that kind of physically aggressive behavior from security. There was definitely lots of complaints about surveillance, about cameras being put up, about things that U of T security would say to student demonstrators while they were on the grounds. That was quite widespread. Interestingly, though, when I talk about, you know, all of these reports of people saying that these students were somehow being violent or hateful, U of T hired more than 24 security after the camp was put in place in order to presumably police whatever behavior people were complaining about. Those security didn't report a single incident that was able to be used in the injunction. The injunction, just for people's curiosity, if they don't know, it was granted by this judge on a very simple principle, which is that U of T is deemed to be private property. And so the school wanted to use its private property for its purposes, and the students wanted to use it for another purpose. And in the end, the judge simply ruled that the school has the right to use its private property as it wishes, and that overrules whatever desire the students have to use it. That was it. That was that simple. It was a simple property dispute. And so they ended up leaving 63 days in because the injunction allowed police to come and to mobilize in large numbers and to come and do whatever they needed to do to clear that space out. And the students, I guess, decided amongst themselves that this wasn't really worth it, that they had made quite a significant stand and they had garnered a lot of community support and raised a lot of visibility about U of T's refusal to disclose its investments and to cut ties with Israeli institutions. And so they took what they had gotten that far and decided to leave before the police could fully mobilize and come in for them. Interestingly enough, though, there was one little capper at the end, which was that because the police needed to justify coming in, after the students left and completely cleared the square, they left behind one thing, which was a papier-mâché olive tree that had a whole bunch of messages on it and solidarity from other groups supporting them and things like that. And they created this and they left it in the middle of the square or the circle when they left. And the police decided that they were going to do a scene and tip it over to examine whether there was a bomb underneath and brought in a bomb squad to make sure that there was no bomb in an empty circle at the university. Of course, pro-Israel demonstrators had actually entered the circle before the police came and tipped the tree over. So it was pretty obvious to anyone who'd been paying attention that there was nothing under there. But, you know, they needed to justify, as they always do, their reason for coming in.
Since the injunction was ordered and students left, what kinds of activism and advocacy are you seeing going on in Toronto around Palestine and the genocide in Gaza?
Well, since October 7th, I would say that the level of advocacy for Palestinian life and in solidarity with Palestinians has been different from anything I've ever really seen in this city, especially in terms of how long it's been sustained. Most weekends, there have been large demonstrations in the downtown parts of the city where hundreds or often thousands of people march through the streets. Those demonstrations have been subject to an unbelievable police crackdown. And it's important to note, too, I think, within that, that the police crackdown is similar to the camp itself, framed as people are being hateful, people are being violent, and we're going after those elements within the demonstrations. We're not simply targeting it because it's a Palestine demonstration. We're targeting within those demonstrations people who are being violent. Now, the majority of that police activity involves presumably violence against themselves. So they introduce themselves with force into a situation and then charge people with things like, obstructing police, assaulting police. But despite that pressure, we have just seen just relentless organizing and demonstrations. We've seen the Giller Prize disrupted in the fall, quite famously. We've seen a large Indigo bookstore be the target of paint and postering, calling out Heather Reisman, the CEO of Indigo Books, because she supports a charity that essentially encourages people to join the Israeli Defense Forces by promising them a scholarship if they do so afterwards. And Heather Reisman's been doing that for a long time and has been being criticized about that for a long time. And so when people did a demonstration at Indigo, the police again treated that as though it was an incident of what they call hate speech or hate crime. And they charged 11 people with a number of very serious crimes. But some of that is already coming unraveled because we now know that at least four of the people charged, their charges have been dropped. One of the men who was charged initially and whose charges were dropped told the media that he wasn't even there, but he lost his job as a result of being arrested. And it's these kinds of stakes that make it so interesting to me to see people continue to come out to go and flood Union Station and take it over, as happened several weeks ago and has happened a few times. There was demonstrations on the Gardiner Expressway that stopped traffic for a short time. There have been demonstrations in front of the Israeli consulate. There have been mass demonstrations in front of Liberal Member of Parliament offices all across the city and throughout the GTA, really. So we're seeing, and we continue to see, this really resilient form of pressure, government pressure, to have a ceasefire, to have a two-way arms embargo where Canada stops sending and receiving arms to and from Israel, and where, you know, we change our diplomatic relationship with this country who, as you say, people believe is engaging in a genocide right now. And the camp was interesting because it became a focal point. It became a place where people could, for example, go after a demonstration. So there'd be a big march through the city and then everybody would end up going to the U of T camp. There was a Stolen Sisters rally held by Indigenous folks who ended up their rally and came into the camp and then did a big teach-in in front of everyone who was there. So you also saw other struggles in the city of Toronto coming together in solidarity, learning, teaching alongside this demonstration for Palestine, which was, it was quite powerful.
And when I was doing my research before we chatted, Desmond, I realized that both you and I, back in 2021, we signed on to this open letter for Canadian newsrooms to kind of have an inflection moment about coverage of Gaza. And just reading from it here, the letter read like, our ask is simple, that all the tenets of journalism should apply to Canadian coverage of occupied Palestinian territories moving forward. Fair and balanced coverage should include historical and social contexts, reporters with knowledge of the region, and crucially, Palestinian voices. And it's just striking to me that 3 years have passed and so little has changed in the way that mainstream media in Canada, not just Canada, but specifically in the country, have been covering this issue. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on the stagnation, on the inability to actually meet the moment and cover this with the respect and dignity that the Palestinian people deserve?
Oh, well, we live in a corporate mainstream media landscape, and I think that that's always important to emphasize first. So we don't have a group of individual journalists going out with their own set of priorities, interests, curiosities. We have people who are assigned to do a job, and they're assigned to do a job on behalf of institutions, large, large institutions that are quite aligned with the Canadian government in their complicity with the state of Israel. The major mainstream networks in this country don't really want, and that includes the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which is publicly owned, but, you know, they don't want there to be a kind of critical conversation as regards Israel. I think it's been fascinating because that's been the case since that letter was signed and for decades before, right? It hasn't changed. What maybe has changed, though, is that there's a certain awareness right now in these last, let's say, 8 months, 9 months, that I have never seen in my own country when it comes to the Palestinian struggle for liberation, for the throwing off of this occupation that's been going on in Gaza for close to, 18 years now, and so much longer in other parts of, you know, occupied Jerusalem and the West Bank. People are learning, and they're doing so despite the fact that the media doesn't want to tell them what's going on. And they're watching social media. And there is a dark side to this. What we get on social media is quite raw and unfiltered. It's not always accurate, I'll say that as well, but no media ever is. I think we are sometimes more likely to trust things that we see on a social media feed that we curate. And so I don't want to suggest that just because we see something in the mainstream, that means it's real. And if it's on social media, it's not. I think it's more complicated than that. And, you know, people are turning to these alternate sources of media to see what the mainstream will not show them. But the dark side of that, of course, is that I open my Twitter feed, for example, and I see bodies of children that are mutilated. And I don't see that on the mainstream, but, you know, I don't know if I want to see that anywhere. I don't know if this new sensational expose of what happens in the world, the way that it's allowed to be filtered right directly to us, I don't know that it's healthy for us, Stephen. And I think about this every day. I say that because in some sense, people are seeing what's really happening in a way that their media doesn't want to show them. And that's important. But we do not need to see the corpses of dead children in Palestine to understand the gravity of what's been going on and what continues to go on there. The siege on Gaza is horrific. I think we can understand that without the gore. I think we can understand that. But you see, we've gone so far in the other direction where people won't show you what you want to see, that now I have people every day posting pictures of just the most horrific things I've ever seen. And they say things like, don't look away, don't look away. And the danger for me here is that people perceive truth as being within this carnage. And I don't think personally, as a journalist, that that's where the truth lies. The truth lies in the disproportionate response by Israel to the Hamas attack of October 7th. The truth lies in the 18-year occupation of Gaza, with air, land, and sea being completely barricaded off from the world, and all aspects of Palestinian life within Gaza being controlled by the Israeli government. The truth lies in the expanding settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Like, that is enough for people to understand what's going on and to want to take action. And we don't need to see Palestinians completely dehumanized, which I feel like is sometimes what's happening, in order for us to care. So I know I'm maybe going a little bit away from your question, but it's like the mainstream won't show you anything, and then social media will show you everything. It'll show you even more than what you want to see, in a way that I feel is also harmful and sometimes irresponsible. So we need to find a balance. We need to find a way to bring stories that doesn't dehumanize, I feel, that actually allows people to maintain their dignity, that brings and centers the voices of people within Gaza right now and within the West Bank and other parts of occupied Palestine, and to hear from them, and not to just witness suffering as a kind of stand-in for proper journalism.
Desmond Cole and Stephen Wenzel in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Desmond and Stephen. Switching gears now, let's review the top stories on Rabble.ca in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn things over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news, a conservative MP is drawing fire after getting into a dispute with his local pride organization. Eric Duncan, MP for Stormont Dundas South Glengarry in Ontario, was the first openly gay conservative MP elected to the House of Commons in Canada. Now, however, he's been engaged with a dispute with his local pride organization, Diversity Cornwall, after he was uninvited from this year's Pride festivities. Duncan, along with his provincial counterpart, Progressive Conservative MPP Nolan Quinn, were uninvited from Pride festivities due to their alleged lack of support for the 2S LGBTQIA+ community. Earlier this year, Quinn voted against legislation that would provide more provincial supports for trans individuals. Duncan, for his part, has failed to stand up to members of his own party, including his leader, who have made public statements targeting the 2S LGBTQIA+ community, particularly trans youths. In labor news, the Sex Workers Action Network of Vancouver is calling out how sex work is being portrayed in news media. The Sex Workers Action Network found that many sex workers were further marginalized and felt humiliated by language used in news stories. One focus group participant expressed frustration over the use of words like brothel or dodgy business. Language like this creates a stigma that can force sex workers into more dangerous situations to practice their profession. Private residences and hotel rooms can leave sex workers without adequate supports when dealing with disputes with clients. It is much safer for sex workers to work within commercial spaces, where there are plenty of colleagues around to offer support. Kelly Goh, program manager of the Sex Workers Action Network of Vancouver, said attention to language in reporting is very important, especially to avoid conflation between human trafficking and sex work. And finally, Rabble agricultural reporter Lois Ross is warning about a potential merger between two giants of the industry, Bunge Limited and Viterra Limited. This merger is a trend in the agricultural sector, which is seeing greater levels of monopolization. The merger is still being reviewed by Canada's competition regulator and will require the approval of the federal government before it can go ahead. The National Farmers Union has been encouraging its members to contact their members of parliament in an effort to halt the approval of the Bunge-Viterra merger. The union worries that the merger will mean less competition, which will result in lower prices for farmers seeking to sell their crops. As always, you can read the full version of the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
In 2024, many indie news media organizations are making the hard decision to close up shop. But with your support, Rabble.ca can continue to share news for the rest of us for years to come. Support Rabble during our summer fundraiser with a one-time or monthly donation. It's never too late to become a Rabble Rouser.
And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and now on YouTube. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Do you want to share Rabble Radio on your local radio station? It's easy. For more information, get in touch with me, Brianne Doyle, at brianne@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
Radio.